So welcome to Introduction to Virtual Machines. This is class number 4. So last class we talked about actually setting up the framework to create our virtual machines. Again, we showed you in Hyper-V how to do it. The book goes through how to do it in VMware Player. Any hypervisor that you use, it's pretty much the same. How to create CPU, reserve memory, reserve hard drive space to create the machines. So today, we're going to talk about actually going through and installing Windows in our virtual environment. Then we're going to go through and install Linux in our virtual environment, see the differences between the two, see the similarities between the two, and talk about some other unique features for it. So before I begin, is there any questions from last time, anything that's come up that anybody wants to ask or talk about? Pretty straightforward. So again, we'll start by talking about Windows on a virtual machine. So we're going to load Microsoft Windows into our virtual machines, talk about loading the VMware tools into our virtual machine and why we install VMware tools, some other configuration options, and how to optimize Windows. So again, installing Windows in a virtual machine is a very similar process to installing it on a physical machine. So in a physical machine, there's multiple ways to do it. In a virtual machine, there's multiple ways to do it. So in a typical installation, back a few years ago, what we do, we'd sit down at our computer, we'd pull out, 3.5-inch floppies, put the floppies in one at a time, we'd get through the 23 disks, right? Probably none of you in this class have done that. Put in a CD-ROM, maybe, DVD-ROM. Depending on what year you did it in, depending what version of Windows. So Windows 95 came on floppy disks. Windows 98 was the first one with CD. Windows 98 SE was the first one to support USB, right? Pretty cool. So nowadays it's DVDs. Nowadays you get, even some software comes on the thumb drives or whatever you want to call them. Thumb drives, portable drives, pen drives, zip drives, dongles, here's a good one. So, just ways of converting files. For this class, what we did, we actually used a Pixie server. We booted into the network, we downloaded our operating system from the network. Again, you can do that. In our virtual machines, we have another option. We can actually load the ISO image. Again, an ISO image is just a copy of a CD or a copy of a disk stored in a file format that it can read. When we mount the ISO image to our virtual machine, it mounts it as a virtual CD-ROM drive. So as far as the virtual machine's concerned, we install physical hardware that's a DVD drive, and it's going to read it like a DVD drive, right? So what's the benefit of having an ISO? An ISO is a compressed image. We can download it legally or not so legally from the internet. Again, Linux free, lots of different Linux ISOs out there, so it's just a matter of grabbing that ISO image, either downloading it directly from there, maybe using a midterm client to download it, whatever way we can get it onto our system. Once it's onto our system, we attach it to our virtual machine, and then it boots it up just like that. Again, if we want to use physical CD-ROM devices, there's ways that we can do that in our virtual environment as well. In terms of a host, we can actually go up to our virtualized host, put the DVD in our host, then point to our host and do it. Typically, when we're connecting to our virtual host, we're not going to be at our virtual host. Again, in this lab, we installed Hyper-V on each and every one of your computers, so you're physically at the host. In a data center environment like we have at the back of the room, I'm not necessarily going to physically insert anything into the data center, right? I'm going to remote into the data center, connect to it. And if I want to feed my virtual machine the disk drive, I have to feed it somehow over the network. And most VMs allow you to actually feed your local disk drive to the remote computer via the software. So again, it will go over the network. In terms of speed, what do you think is the fastest way for it to load software onto your virtual machine? So again, I just talked about a bunch of different ways to do it, right? Virtually half. Through the network. So the Pixie server. So file or data clients. So again, we talk CD-ROM drives. So CD-ROM drives all have read-write speeds, right? So if you're putting a CD-ROM into the physical host, you're limited by the read-write speeds of the CD-ROM drive. If you're SATA, that's what? 200 megs per second, something like that. Depending on which version of SATA you're using. Depending on how fast your CD-ROM drive is, if it's a Blu-ray or if it's an older one. So maybe 200 megs a second. If you're using a USB to plug in, again, is it USB 2.0? If it's 2.0, you're limited to what, 20 megs per second, give or take. If it's 3.0, 100, 200 megs a second. Good luck getting those speeds, but theoretically. Thunderbolt, you know, different write speeds. Again, different ways of doing it, different things like that. So again, now we talk ISO image. So now we have an ISO image, which is just a file on disk. How are you storing it on disk? Again, we'll talk about storage later on. That'll come up. What type of storage are you using? Are you using SATA local storage? Again, you're limited by your SATA speeds. But again, that's still like 300-400 megabits per second. So yay! Now we're talking. Network speeds, maybe up to 1 gig if you have a gig connection. So now you're talking equivalent speed. If I'm reading from a CD-ROM that I have installed on my client machine and I'm trying to feed it to a remote computer, now I have my CD-ROM read speeds and then the network going to the client. So now you're talking slow. Again, it's not incredibly awful nowadays because we have fast networks, because we have fast CD-ROM drives. But again, the easiest way to do it, load a file locally and do it from that. So if you're running on an environment and you're loading Windows images all the time, I recommend that you store the ISO file somewhere near your hypervisor. That way you have quick access to it whenever you're creating your machines. And again, last week we talked about some different ways to create virtual machines, cloning, templating, things like that. Maybe you don't even need the ISO more than once in your environment. So again, when we go to create our machine, we create our virtual hardware. We tell it how much disk space it's going to have. Again, the amount of disk space that we allocate to it is going to be taken from the entire pool that we have. So again, in our data center here, we have something like 40 terabytes. My virtual machines that I create aren't going to have 40 terabytes of space, right? I'm going to tell it 80 gigs. 80 gigs standard pretty much for a Windows installation. Minimum is 20. If you want to do updates, you need at least 40. So, double 40, that's 80. There we go. Again, always good to take a minimalist approach. Don't give it all the memory it would ever need. If you need to add hard disks later, you can do that. You can expand the disks later. If you gave it 40 terabytes right off the bat, it's pretty hard to take it back from Windows, right? Windows, when you give it space, it starts writing everywhere. It doesn't even know where it writes half the time. So trying to grab that partition space back is pretty hard. RAM, again, we give it some type of RAM. Again, take the minimalist approach. Don't immediately give it 32 gigs of RAM. You know, hey, but that's what I'm going to need. Yeah, maybe. Depends on what you're running. 2, 4, 8. 8's even a lot for most of the applications that you run in a virtual environment. Again, there's other devices that you can install here that are machine specific. Again, it allows the hypervisor to talk to them. Windows likes to install them automatically. So you'll notice Windows, again, 80 gigs. Why does it take up 80 gigs? Because it likes to install things for you. Oh, you might need this in 10 years, so we'll install it for you. 20 years later, you're still not using anything that they've automatically installed for you, but hey, it's there, in case you ever decide you need to. Again, we allocate resources. You can look at the amount of resources that are allocated to the host. It should match, or pretty close. The other thing that we talk about with VMware, it also comes up in Xen, but not so much in Hyper-V, is the tool set that you install to go with it. So VMware tools are a specific set of tools that facilitate the communication between the guest operating system and the hypervisor. So one way that most people tell that they're connected to a virtual machine instead of a physical machine is that they see VMware tools are installed, right? It's a pretty dead giveaway. If there's virtual tools installed on your operating system, probably in a virtual environment. But what these tools do are facilitate changes to the operating system and facilitate the way that memory is used. So again, we've said that there's a consolidation ratio that we have, something like 10 to 1 or 15 to 1, depending on what type of environment we're running. So we're going to allocate more virtual resources than there are physical resources. Well, the hypervisor has to keep track of who's using those resources. And if resources are needed in one place rather than another, it needs to be able to reclaim them and repurpose them. VMware tools facilitates that communication by keeping constant contact with the guest operating system. If it sees that you need more RAM, it gives you more RAM. When it sees that you're done with the RAM, it takes the RAM away from you. Again, it's not required to be installed in any operating system. You don't have to install VMware tools, but they recommend it. In terms of use, when we go and actually install our VMware environment, we set up our VMware environment, and you may have noticed this with some Type 2 hypervisors. When you click into it, it grabs control of the mouse and the keyboard, and then you have to use some special command to get and break out of it. When you install VMware tools, it actually facilitates that communication better. You don't have to use an escape sequence. It knows whether you're talking to the virtual machine or to your regular operator. So we'll see that when we go and actually install that. And again, that's going to come up later in the chapters as well. Again, we can configure the memory. It will show us, based on the operating system that we've chosen, what the minimum amount is for that guest operating system, what the recommended memory is for the guest operating system is, and what the maximum memory of the guest operating system is. And again, depending on what version of Windows that you're running, depending on if it's the 32-bit version or the 64-bit version, you are limited on the resources that it can handle, right? So the 32-bit version of Windows 7 can support up to 32 or 64, one of those. But the 64-bit version supports a lot more. Again, 64-bit version assumes that you're running servers, assumes that you're running things like Hyper-V, so it knows that you're going to need more memory in your system. The desktop versions, the 32-bit versions of the systems, assume that you're running locally and assume that you're only using the resources that are given to you. Again, virtual machines, you can go and reconfigure them pretty easily. So you want to add more RAM, right-click, open, add more RAM. Hyper-V typically requires that you shut the machine off to add resources. VMware is a little bit better, allows you to do a lot of things hot. Again, depending on what services you're running in the guest operating system, you may need to shut the machine down anyway to add the resources to get it to recognize. Again, SQL servers, they like to eat RAM, but if you hot add the RAM, it doesn't know that you've added it until you reboot the system. So just be aware of that. And again, with virtual machines, you're not turning off the machine, unplugging it, putting on your static wristband, touching something metal. You all do that, right, when you add RAM to your computer?
No.
Right?
No.
Making sure that you get rid of that static electricity before you touch any of your internal components. It only takes once to screw up a system beyond repair, and you will always put that wristband on.
I just touched the side of the case.
Yeah, touching the side of the case. Wear very thick rubber shoes, maybe. Arcing is awesome. Again, there's no danger of that in the virtual environment because all you're doing is writing out to that file and replacing a number, right? Again, virtual machines, just files stored on disks, so when it goes to look at its virtual hardware, it's looking at an XML file that has a number. Right? And the hypervisor is going to take care of the communication back and forth. So, again, I said Windows is kind of bloatware, right? Windows likes to install a lot of things that you're never going to use. It doesn't know what the purpose of that machine is, right? It doesn't know if you're going to run an email server. It doesn't know if you're going to run a file server. It doesn't know if you're just going to run World of Warcraft. So it has to install some things that it thinks you're going to use so that when you go to actually do the things you're going to do, they're there for you and ready to use. Again, some other operating systems take a different approach to this. They don't install anything. So anytime you try to go and do anything, you have to install packages. Windows users are simple. Remember, we don't want to have to think. We don't want to have to install packages to be able to use it. So it goes and installs the packages for us. Well, we're smarter than that. We're smarter than our Windows operating system, right? Sometimes. Not me, but that's okay. So we know what we're going to use and what we're never going to use, right? So after we've set up our virtual machine, once we know what the processes are going to be running on it, we can go in and turn a lot of those extra features off and remove them from our system. And by removing them from our system, we're actually increasing the performance of both our machine and our virtual environment. So depending on what hypervisor you're using, they all have recommendation sheets of what you should do to go in and increase the performance on your machines. So on VMware's websites, you can type in Windows performance, and it will show you what services it says you don't need. And the reason that it knows what services you don't need, because it knows what the hypervisor does and what the hypervisor is going to control for you. Again, Windows, when you install it as a guest operating system, assumes that it has to communicate to the physical hardware. It doesn't. The hypervisor does. So you can turn a lot of those features off. So VMware has its own recommendation sheet. Hyper-V has its own recommendation sheet. I believe I've uploaded some of those performance recommendation sheets to CM Connect. If not, they're easily findable by going to the company's website and Googling that information. Again, you're not going to be able to go to VMware's website and find Hyper-V's recommendations, right? You go to VMware's website and type in Hyper-V, it will tell you how bad it is. You go to Microsoft's website, you type in VMware, it will tell you how bad VMware is, right? All from the perspective, right? So, yes. So, you go into Zen's website and they'll tell you how Zen is the greatest thing in the entire world. Right? And maybe it is. Who knows? And again, the idea is to make it as lean as possible, optimized as possible. You're not only going to increase the performance on that machine, you're going to increase the performance on your virtual environment as a whole. Right? Because if this machine is taking RAM to go and do things that it doesn't need to do, you're taking away from the entire pool of RAM that's available to your systems. So again, installing Windows into the virtual environment, very identical to installing it in the physical environment, right? We're just going to do it. How do we do it? We can do it via disk. We can do it via USB. We can do it via ISO file. Again, ISO files tend to be the easiest in our virtual environment. Everything stored as a file in our virtual environment. Why not add an operating system as a file too? Have it there, have it ready to go. Again, VMware tools installed to enhance the user experience, enhance the performance of the virtual machines. Not by any means required, right? Last week we talked about the OBF implementations. We talked about OBA files. Again, if I'm going to make an OBF file, maybe I'm going to have it install VMware tools automatically. That's all well and great, except for when I created it, it may have been VMware tools 7, and now they're up to 11. So you'll see tools are out of date when you start to do things, and we'll recommend that you update them. Some updates apply without having to restart the guest operating system. Some actually make you reboot the guest operating system. Again, when we get into VMware and start pushing out VMware tools, you'll see that you have options to push them out to every machine at once. You can do one machine at a time. You can force it to reboot if it needs to reboot, or you can tell it not to reboot. Just be aware with Windows operating systems, when you install updates, when you install patches, and you don't reboot the system, eventually it's going to cause you issues, right? It's going to start to lag. It's going to start to cause performance. It says that you can install them and not reboot, but when you install them, it's usually better to reboot at that point in time, right? Or wait and install them when you know you're going to reboot, because they go into stupid state. Happens with the email servers especially. Exchange is awful. That you install updates, it turns off the Exchange service until you reboot the system. Oh, you don't need to reboot, but I'm not going to work. Fair enough. Stop. And again, Windows is bloatware. Windows wants you to turn off the components that you're not going to use to be able to increase the performance, both in your machine and in the environment. So that's it for really installing Windows. And again, we'll go through and do that in our virtual environment here at the end of our lectures today. Chapter 6 starts with installing Linux. Any questions on Windows? You've all installed Windows before, I'm sure, unless this is your first class, first time at CMCC. And even then, you should have done it for this class. So we've all gone through Windows installation. What you may not have done to this point is install the version of Linux. And again, what we're going to show you today and what you're going to find out is that it's not that difficult. It's the same kind of idea. You may see a few different options that you may or may not know what they're talking about. And again, at this point in its life cycle, Linux has released some idiot-proof versions. So I can even use it. It's awesome, right? Ubuntu, yeah. Ubuntu is the Windows version of Linux. So you can install it without knowing anything about Linux. Yay!
You can install it from Windows.
You can install it from Windows?
Yeah.
Kali lets you install from Windows too, right? I saw a setup file on the ISO.
Yes.
Yeah.
Kali is
perfect. Yeah. So back in the day, when Windows was young and you wanted to dual boot, you had to worry about partition managers and you had to worry about space, and you could really mess up your Windows file system by trying to install anything Linux on the same computer. So people kept two computers. Some people nowadays like to dual boot still. Dual booting, again, you're messing with your grub or your Windows boot manager. You're telling who's going to have priority over the system and who's going to dictate the rules that go along. The safer way to do it is to install that Type 2 hypervisor, right? So now the hypervisor is going to talk to the operating system, and there's little to no chance that you can screw up your master boot record and not be able to boot your system, right? You want to get rid of Windows when you're within your Linux KVM? All you got to do is delete that Windows virtual disk that you created. It's not going to mess up your Linux system at all, right? You don't have to worry about resizing your partition spaces, giving hardware back, anything like that, right? You don't have to worry most of the time about device-specific drivers because the hypervisor is going to take care of all that interaction for you. So again, we're going to talk about the steps to load Linux. The books goes through Red Hat. In class here, I think we could do Ubuntu, we could do Kali, we could do, what else is there? G-parted. You could use any distro. I'm talking about the ones that I have already set up to like load in like 3 seconds. And then, again, you can download any ISO that you want. So if you take the Linux class here, part of what the Linux class does is go through the distributions and has you install umpteen hundred distributions.
And do a report
to find out on one. When I learned Linux, that was not what I learned. I learned the back end. I learned ls, bash, shell, grep, all that. That is not what Linux is today. So it's still there. It's still important to know. When you take advanced Linux, it's critical. If it ever runs. But again, you can use Linux and not have to know terminal commands. Good, bad, and different. Yeah. I think it's bad.
Let's all get in the
room. End users think it's good. What was that?
Let's all get in the room. Start playing the room.
There you go. Why not?
Let's just
destroy everything.
So, again, when you go to install VMware Tools, you can install VMware Tools in a Linux machine. So VMware Tools, when you go to install in Linux, is a little harder, right? They don't make anything easy to interact with Linux. And I think they do that on purpose to keep everybody out of Linux. Which is okay. So, when you install VMware Tools, usually there's command line scripts that you have to run to get it to run. When you do it within Windows, it does it automatically, installs CXC, and lets you go. Again, that kind of goes back to the security precautions that are in the operating system. Windows doesn't care. Oh, you inserted a disk. Here, let me install that file for you. But, no, you inserted it. It's fine. It'll run. Linux, you might want to run something, but you got to tell me what you want me to run and how you want me to run it, right? We'll talk about some virtual machine configurations, and so, again, there's some optimizations for the Windows virtual machine. And some of the recommendations that the author makes in the book, I think, are a little even outdated for Linux nowadays, because the distributions have changed a little bit, but they're generally good recommendations as a whole. So again, why do we talk Linux? Linux is huge as a server operating system. So Apache is one version, but Apache will also run on Microsoft. So Tomcat Apache is not really there. But as a server whole, so why are they saying server operating system? So Apache is an application that runs on a server. But when we talk server operating systems, maybe we're talking Solaris, maybe we're talking SUSE Linux. What other? Red Hat is huge, yeah. Yeah. So why do you think people are choosing Linux over Windows for their server environments?
More control.
More control. It's designed to be a server. So I would agree that those are important points, but I wouldn't say that's why anybody switches to Linux. It's free, right? Yeah. Why do you want to pay for a server when you can get the same thing for free, right? So back in the day, again, we're talking 10 years ago, Windows users didn't understand how Linux worked. You get a command prompt and they're like, what is this? Throw their hands up in panic, right? Nowadays, everything's graphical user interfaces, everything's easier to configure, it'll configure a lot of things for you. Information-wise, we've moved to a point in society where you can Google almost anything, right? How do I configure a Linux server? Boom! 50,000 matches, right? More than that, billion. 9.6 billion ways to do it. My argument to you is to not trust Google because Google lies, right? As many correct ways to do it out there, there is as equally as many incorrect ways to do it. People aren't concerned about the security of your system when they're telling you to run commands over the internet, right? Right? Open up all these ports. That'll make your system work, right? Also, give me your IP address. Oh, just paste your configuration file here so we can take a look at it. With all your access control lists, with all your IP addresses, with all your public facing things.
Don't forget your bank statement, yeah. And your 401k, and your social security numbers.
And it's scary how many systems administrators will post their log files without knowing what's actually in their log files that they're posting. Be aware when you go to a public forum that you're posting information to a public forum. I'm not saying don't. You can. Just make sure you scrub the information before you do it. Again, remove any IP addresses, anything that will link to your physical hardware, MAC addresses, things like that. Make sure that's all taken out. If you're dealing with support, support may ask for it, but if you're paying for Cisco support and they want a copy of your config, give it to them, right? You're paying them to do it. They're not going to hack your system. And if they do, so I was going to say, they don't, yeah. The vendors of the hardware that you're using don't need your permission to access it. You, Again, the subscriber use agreements. If you plug in this hardware and you use this hardware, you agree to let us have access to it at any point in time for any reason that we want. Again, installing Microsoft, you've basically given permission over every file that you have on your Microsoft system to them. Here you go.
They own it.
They own it. You use things like Dropbox. Dropbox owns all your Dropbox files, right? Facebook, things like that. You got to be very concerned with who owns what. Again, I'm from an education environment, public, institution. I don't care about most of the things that I share, right? It's my documents. I created it. I'm giving it to you guys, so whoever gets it from that point on doesn't matter, right? But if I work for a multi-billion dollar company and I have a document that has proprietary secrets in it, hey, my next version of operating system is going to look like this, and I have all kinds of screenshots and stuff, I don't necessarily want that uploaded to Dropbox. If I have a document that has you guys' grades on it, and it has all your social security numbers, all your student IDs, all your phone numbers, all your addresses, do you want me to upload that to Dropbox? Probably not, right? You don't want somebody else to own that, right? So that's why I use CM Connect, right? CM Connect is by the school, and the school has security in place to protect it. Do I agree that it's great security? Do I agree that it's perfect? No, but nothing in society is perfect. Is it good enough for the purposes of the school? Yes. So do I use it? Yes. Right? But if I'm running my own business and I'm trying to keep my own secrets, I'm going to be more concerned with the security of my files and how that information is presented. And again, there's software out there that will let you do private things, that will let you encrypt things in your own system. And again, how good is it? That's for you to find out.
Like Mega?
Mega? I've never heard of Mega, but...
Oh, Mega Upload
is the new thing, yeah. Never heard of that, so...
It's been on for quite a while. Qube.com.
Is it a BitTorrent client?
Yeah, Mega Upload, yeah. You get a lot of BitTorrent.
Yeah.
It's actually more of a site that isn't client.
Gotcha. But again, that's open file sharing. So BitTorrents are open file sharing. They're not meant to restrict access, right? Here, everybody have this. Everybody share this. Everybody take a bit of this file, and then everybody else is going to download from everybody else. Yeah. P2P. And it's not really P2P. It's something else. It's not peer-to-peer. It's peer-to-peer. Yeah. Yeah. And you grab little bits and pieces, and then you make sure the CRC check matches up so that it's the actual what you want. So, again, Linux servers, free, easier to use, easier to implement, so people start using them. There's turnkey systems out there, so LAMP is a turnkey web-based application that installs Apache, that installs management right from the get-go. All you have to do is download the OVF file, install the OVF file into your system, give it an IP address, and it's up and running. Right? It's great. Again, me, if I'm running it for a business, I'm going to go in and secure it more, put in some site certificates, validation, things like that. But it does what it wants. So, again, older days, people used different server operating systems. Green screen. What's IBM's green screen? I can't think of the name of it. I'll think of it. Again, those are expensive. They're out of date. They don't interact well with the cloud environment. So as they're falling out, people are migrating to Linux. Again, Windows is there. Windows still has a loud and large presence in the server environment. They want you to use it. But again, what happens when Windows needs to update? Windows updates, and then you need to reboot your Windows system. So that's downtime for companies. Companies don't like it when you turn off their servers. Again, how do you get past that? You cluster things. You move services over to machines while you're rebooting other machines. But that's a lot of money, a lot of work, and hard. Linux machines, you can run them, you can install updates without ever powering them off. So I had one Linux machine that was on for, I think, like 17 years. we hadn't turned it off. When we turned it off, it didn't come back on, but that's besides the point. For 17 years, it ran great. Then we went to upgrade it to a new system, so we had to turn the old one off, and when we turned the old one off, the new one didn't take over all that stuff, so we tried to turn the old one back on, and it wouldn't come back on. So, and this goes back to my argument, tape drives are not the way to back up your data. Because that's what this we were copying the data over with, was using tape drives, because that's what they supported. So, and again, it was Cisco, so we had Cisco support on the line. And they were like, oh, that's not good. Then eventually they had an Oracle database engineer actually rebuilding the Oracle database from scratch, which is amazing, because to ever get an Oracle engineer on the line that does stuff like that takes a lot of work. So we know that it was an important issue. But it's a slow and tedious process rebuilding databases like that. So they were down, I think, like 8 hours. In terms of an ISP being down for 8 hours, that's not a good thing. So, again, newer applications are being open source architecture frameworks rather than vendor-specific solutions. So in the older days, you used to have to go out to a specific person. They would customize you a solution, and you would buy that solution from them. Now companies are releasing open source products. They want you to use that, and then what they want you to pay for is the support for those open source products. Solutions. And again, the largest factor, lower cost. Money, 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 money. Right? That's what it comes down to. So earlier I talked about Microsoft Hyper-V. So Hyper-V is free. Right? As long as you're running Linux machines. Right? So you can run a Hyper-V server, you can run Linux machines, and not have to pay software license costs. Now I want to run Hyper-V, but I want to install Server 2012 R2. Now I need to buy a Microsoft site license. Right? So Hyper-V server is free. Server 2012 costs money. Make sense? So how do we install Linux onto a VM? Again, same way we do it on a physical server. We have to have some medium to transfer the operating system to the disk, right? So we have to have it write to that file. How do we do it? DVD drive, CD-ROM drive, USB keys, ISO files, same as Windows, Pixie server. So today we can use the Pixie server to install Linux into our guest operating systems. Again, whichever flavor of Linux you're installing, it's going to look and feel a little bit different. But for the most part, it's inserting the disk, hitting enter a bunch of times, right? Yeah. With Linux, though, it asks you some questions that Windows doesn't. So Windows, again, assumes that it knows what it's doing and doesn't bother asking and checking with you to make sure things are okay. Linux, depending on what flavor you're installing, will ask you certain questions, and you can select the default answer, or you can change it. So again, it asks you what kind of volume manager you want to use, usually, and things like that. Again, the Linux installer can only see what you allocate to that virtual machine. So we have a 40 terabyte SAN, but if we only allocate 80 gigabytes of storage to our box, it's only going to see that 80 gigabytes of storage, right? Again, it's not going to write outside of its bounds. It says recommending 10, 20 gigabytes. Is that standard for Linux installation nowadays? So, again, 80 for Windows, 20 for Linux. And again, when we go to install the tools, we actually have to go and drop to a root user, or we have to sudo. So sudo means I'm the root. You could also su. Su is the older versions of Linux, which means super user. Again, I'm not concerned with you learning Linux at this point. We have a class that teaches Linux. I suggest that you take that class if you haven't taken that class yet. Advanced Linux, I think, is being offered coming up here pretty soon.
Who's teaching advanced?
I can't remember. She said there's an adjunct who teaches it, who's taught it in the past. So, I know enough about Linux to be dangerous. I know enough about Linux to be dangerous, and I know enough about C that I can speak intelligently about Linux. But certainly, going in depth in Linux takes a different skill set. Again, the Linux virtual machine, only going to see what's allocated, be it in terms of memory, things like that. Again, the drop down, when we're selecting our virtual machine, we're creating our virtual hardware, it asks us what operating system we're going to install. If I use the drop down and I select Debian Linux, that doesn't mean it's the only type of Linux I can install. If I go into our Hyper-V and I say I'm installing Debian Linux, and I'm going to do this, it's going to show me the recommendations for memory. When I get to the end, if I insert the Windows ISO, it's going to install Windows onto that disk space, right? The only benefit that we get by selecting the correct operating system is the recommendations that it gives us for the memory allocation for the hard drive space is based on that known parameters of that operating system. So, again, it's just a label. It doesn't really matter because it's not going to affect the performance of the virtual machine or the guest operating. So Linux, again, and this is the information that I kind of stepped back from. In the early days of Linux, this was critically important. Nowadays, I'm not so sure that it's as relevant. But they always recommend that you have an NTP server installed in your Linux environment. Again, an NTP server in any environment is important. But the author says that it's critically important for Linux because so much is dependent around security certificates and the fact that when it goes to download its updates, when it goes to actually connect to the internet, it's all looking at that Linux security certificate information. So the NTP or network time protocol is going to keep the time in sync for the server. So later on again when we talk VMware, VMware has its own NTP clock built into it and will sync our guest operating systems to the host VM. So everybody's going to talk to the host that it's hosted on and get its time from them, so all of the virtual machines in your environment will all run the same time. When we have multiple hosts, we have to be able to sync the time between the hosts. Again, any information that's passed between the hosts is going to be timed, and if those clocks are off, then it's going to cause issues in our network and things of that nature. So timing is important. So, again, here the author says everything's dependent on the time in Linux. Well, everything's dependent on the time in most operating systems nowadays, and an NTP clock is important. So then the argument comes, do you create your own NTP clock? Do you use somebody else's NTP clock? So I know that in this classroom, people historically have had issues with the Windows time server, that it's off. So their hours will be off by 3 or 4. It just synced to the NTP time server and my time is off by 4 hours. That's never a good thing. Yeah, could be. They swore they weren't. I didn't check. I would have assumed time zone if it was off by an even hour. Again, there's other NTP sources out there. The last one that was really recommended to me as a server administrator was pool.ntp. Where they actually take a number of NTP servers, kind of give you the average of the time to make everything kind of stick. Again, as long as you're syncing to something and every machine in your network has the same time, you shouldn't have too many issues, but you should have them synced. Again, just like Windows, Linux likes to turn on some processes that it thinks it's going to need. Linux, again, depending on what version you're using, we'll do it differently. So Kali Linux is very secure, and it doesn't turn on a lot of unnecessary processes. It doesn't even turn on some necessary processes automatically. It makes you do it. There's other versions like Ubuntu that are loud like Windows, and will start turning random things on to try to get you up and running faster. And again, it assumes that it knows what you're going to use it for, so it does it. And again, our virtual machines aren't talking directly to our physical hardware. All that communication is facilitated by the hypervisor, so it doesn't need all of the daemons or all the processes that are running. So in Windows, or sorry, in Linux, you can go to a command prompt, you can type ps. PS shows you the running processes. Again, just like the Windows Task Manager, there's going to be a bunch of things listed there. If you get bored and you want to see what does what, just type kill and then the process ID, it'll turn it off. Unlike Windows, it lets you do it to things that you need. So eventually your machine will shut down, but it's fun. Windows says, no, no, I need that, I can't turn that off. Or no, no, the hacker that subscribed that process was very good at what he was doing, so you can't turn that off. So, again, in Windows there's ways around it, in Linux it just lets you do it. But there's, again, documentation on the hypervisor manufacturer's websites that will tell you what to do in order to optimize the performance of your virtual machine and have it out there. So, again, last week we talked OVF. So OVF is the template that's used to create machines. I can import a Linux OVF into my virtualized environment. Again, because it's OVF, it hasn't been streamlined to my environment, so I may need to go in and turn off some other processes. However, if somebody deploys a VDK file and I import it into VMware, I assume that they've already gone through and trimmed it to match VMware, because it's a VMware file, it should be optimized for VMware performance. That makes sense. Again, that OVF is just a template. It doesn't know what environment you're using. So when you import it, it may or may not be set to the specifications that you need for your environment. So again, that's just something you should check in both Windows and Linux VMs that you load. So that's really it for this chapter. Any questions on any of that? Again, pretty straightforward. So for the exercises today, we'll go through actually installing some of those. We'll install a version of Windows, we'll install a version of Linux, and you can see the difference.